Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran urges the UN to prevent misuse of Resolution 2231, saying the ban on Tehran's arms exports expired in 2020. Palestinians lead to arrest a teenage boy killed by Israeli soldiers overnight in the occupied West Bank. And a survey finds that about 85% of people in Britain have to cut their food spending to save money as the cost of living continues to rise. Hello and welcome to your company from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran says there is no legal ground to link a UN Security Council resolution endorsing the 2015 deal to allegations that Russia uses Iran-made drones in the Ukraine war. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Saidi Ravani, made the remarks in a letter to the Secretary General after Ukrainian officials called on the world body to inspect downed drones in the country. Kiev accuses Tehran of violating UN Resolution 2231 by providing Russia with drones, a charge Tehran denies vehemently. Iravani rejected Kiev's allegations as unfounded and a misrepresentation of the UN resolution. He said an embargo on Iran's arms exports under the resolution was expired in October 2020. He also noted that the arms restrictions applied to the transfer of missile technology designed to be capable of carrying nuclear warheads. Iravani also called on the UN chief not to allow any abuse of the resolution for the sake of the war in Ukraine.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days.
Kiev and some of its Western backers accuse Iran of supplying Russia with Iran 2 drones. Ukraine claims Russia has acquired as many as 2,400 of the UAVs. The West accuses Iran of breaching a UN resolution that placed an arms embargo on Tehran. The embargo expired in 2020 despite Washington's efforts to renew the measure.
The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed 136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
Tehran says the claims of Western countries to support Iranian women are not sincere and in good faith, stressing that Iranian women do not need guardians.
Iranian women are smart, well-educated, dedicated, and patriotic and are aware of their rights. They also understand how to engage with the government in a peaceful and constructive manner in order to advance their rights. Therefore, we advise those Western states that they are not required to act as guardians or caretakers of Iranian women or speak on their behalf.
Zahra Ershadi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on women, peace and security. She criticized some Western countries for what she called baseless allegations against the Islamic Republic under the pretext of supporting Iranian women. Ershadi denounced those allegations as attempts to politicize women's rights, adding that such claims are in line with double-standard approaches toward human rights. She noted that inhumane anti-Iran sanctions by the U.S. have violated the basic rights of Iranian women. Ershadi also pointed to the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini in mid-September, which sparked riots in Iran.
The tragic death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian girl, has broken the hearts of not only our government, but also the people of my country. We regret the incident and hope to never have to witness such a heartbreaking loss again. A thorough investigation was carried out to determine the circumstances that led to this tragic death. So far, the findings of two preliminary investigations have been shared with member states and UN-affiliated organizations.
Ershadi talked about the significant role of women in Iran's various domains. She said more than half of the population of Iranian university students are comprised of females. Ershadi said 73% of Iran's medical specialists are now made up of women. A funeral has been held for the 19-year-old Palestinian who lost his life during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mourners condemned Israeli crimes and called for justice. Salah Bariki died after being shot in the neck as Israeli forces stormed Jenin in the early hours of Friday. Three other Palestinians were also wounded during the raid. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in Jenin, killing dozens of Palestinians during its raids. The latest victim brings to 124 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. A new survey shows British consumers are cutting food spending to save money as the cost of living reaches new highs. The study conducted by the British Consumer Protection Association says about 85% of people in the UK have cut their food spending since August. It also shows that people are trying to buy promotional foods and spend less on expensive items. People in the UK have been feeling the squeeze of soaring prices for months. Britain's inflation is now at a four-decade high. This is driven by inflated food and energy prices due to the crisis in Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. I'm now joined by Steve Keen. He is an economist and author from Amsterdam. Steve, welcome to the program. Let us discuss the ongoing crisis in the UK and the contributor factors that have caused this crisis. Maybe one factor is fundamental flaws and shortcomings in the UK's economic system.
Well, the UK is an importer of food. It imports at least 30% of the food that it eats. And though it's gone further in getting renewable energy than most countries around the world, it's still heavily dependent upon imported oil. So the combination of not being able to control its food production and relying upon imported energy, it's extremely vulnerable. And given the incredibly skewed distribution of income in the UK, the very low level of income of at least 40% of the population, that much of the population will be sent bankrupt by higher food prices and higher energy. So what we're really seeing in some ways is the breakdown of the price system.
And Steve, political instability in the UK, especially uncertainty over the future of number 10 Downing Street, it has severely exacerbated the problem. So Boris Johnson left the Partygate scandal and Liz Truss resigning after 44 days with her controversial economic package. And now, again, the Tory party is trying to find a candidate that can just rein in the inflation and also put an end to this crisis that has engulfed the entire nation. Now, how grim the prospects, in your opinion, are coming winter?
Oh, they're terrible. I mean, the idea to put a cap on energy prices was essential, because if you don't do it over winter, then many people are going to be unable to keep warm and you'll have people dying of hypothermia. Which is ridiculous in what's supposed to be a advanced developed country. So it's just a sign that the austerity programs that Britain has been dominated for by over a decade now, they don't have the physical resources needed. They should have been building the physical resources, and that requires deficits, government spending. It requires investment. All these things haven't been happening in the UK for virtually 20 years. So it's a sign that the focus upon trying to balance the books has actually led to the crisis they're in now.
And finally, Steve, one other contributive factor here is the war in Ukraine and the sanctions on Russia, and Russia reducing its oil supplies to Europe and the UK, which basically acts as a domino effect here, because the UK doesn't import much gas and oil from Russia directly. So how much of a role do you think sanctioning Russia has played in exacerbating the ongoing energy crisis and cost of living crisis in the UK?
Not as much as it's done for Germany, obviously, because Germany relied directly upon energy imports from Russia. But just the overall fragility of the British economy, it shouldn't be running a balance of trade deficit at the scale that it's running. It should have decent industry, and it's run that down over the last 40 years with a belief they can replace it with service exports, and that has never worked. So you've got basically a wrong direction which has been carried up by the ruling parties there ever since the days of Maggie Thatcher, and what you're really seeing is an economy ruining itself. So I think the Russian sanctions and so on minor compared to what they've done to Germany, but they're still pointing out just how unprepared England is for crises coming forward because of the focus it's taken to saving for a rainy day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for the time. Steve Keen, an economist and an author from Amsterdam. Thank you for joining us. Moving on, Turkey calls for lifting of sanctions against Iran and Venezuela amid soaring energy prices worldwide.
The entire world needs Venezuela's oil and natural gas. but they have imposed sanctions. On the other side, there has been embargoes on the Iranian oil. Our private companies and refineries can't buy oil from Iran, and they buy it from elsewhere. Why? Because there are sanctions. Lift the sanctions, my brother, if you want to drop in prices, and let the producing countries provide energy to the markets.
Çavuşoğlu also said no problem can be solved by threatening countries. Venezuela has been hit by U.S. oil sanctions since 2019. The U.S. has also imposed an embargo on Iran's oil industry in 2018 after it withdrew from the nuclear deal. The war in Ukraine has triggered an energy crisis worldwide. European Union leaders have failed to find immediate practical solutions at their summit called to address an energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine. After lengthy talks in Brussels, the leaders failed to impose a price cap on gas to counter a slash in supplies from Russia to the bloc. However, they agreed to keep working on a roadmap to contain energy prices for households and businesses. European Council President Charles Michel said the energy crisis represents a threat to the bloc's internal market. He said a maximal coordination was needed to address the issue. Before the summit, Germany refused to back calls for a cap on gas prices, but in a sign of concession, Berlin also agreed to work on mechanisms for containing prices. French President Emmanuel Macron, who had gone into the summit, expressed satisfaction with the outcome of the meeting. That's a wrap for this hour's World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. O my brother believer, live up to your name. O my brother, if someone calls you a believer, you are happy. But if someone raises the slightest doubt about your faith, you're upset. You might tell me, what's the point in telling us we don't really have faith and we don't really believe in your speeches? Oh, my so-called believing brother, do you do infaq? Remember, this isn't just about whether you spend money. You spend a lot of money. You spend so much money during the month of Ramadan. You cook delicious food. You lay out an impressive spread. You invite your friends and family. You spend a lot. But do you also do infaq? Dear speaker, how much you speak, how much you breathe, how much you use your lungs, your chest, your existence, your body and your limbs, how much you deploy your powers of explanation, but do you do infaq from this power? It is not artful to speak a lot, rather, saying that which needs to be said, that is artful. The first is not infaq, only the second is. O you who spends his high dignity and prestige, you write a letter to someone. You have a meeting with someone to achieve something. You see someone to make sure they do what you wanted. Someone tells someone else to do something. Someone worthy of respect uses someone to get somewhere. You spend your dignity and prestige, but do you do infaq with it?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
O you who spends his wealth in various ways, whether in the name of religion or the name of something else. Yes, sometimes a person spends his money in the name of religion without that being infaq. Do not be surprised about this, as it does happen. And how bitter it is when it does. You give so much money in the name of religion, you spend so much, but this still isn't infaq because you aren't filling a gap, because you're not curing an ailment, because you are not meeting a need that is present in society. No, the real capital of the believer, the thing that is the mark of a true believer, is nothing other than infaq. And spend, yunfiquna, out of what we have provided them. So if you really want to give your time, or your dignity, or your money, or something, you had better think long and hard. Is this really infaq, or are you just spending haphazardly? It is they who are the truly faithful. They shall have ranks near their Lord, forgiveness. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 4. This is the same forgiveness, maghfirah, whose meaning we explained in yesterday's lecture, and I hope that you can recall what we discussed.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
In 2020, as COVID-19 spread around the world, a different kind of epidemic was sweeping across America. Murder spiked by 30%. That is the biggest jump in modern history. Other violent crimes also saw a huge surge. While the COVID pandemic is now over, the epidemic of crime is not and is still wreaking havoc in many parts of the country.
Rampant crime.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In today's episode, we'll discuss a surge in crimes across the U.S. Violent crimes, in particular gun violence, have touched every aspect of American life in recent years. A church, a grocery store, concerts, schools, you name it. Now, some of the casualties have been children who one day woke up, went to school, and never came back. So what's behind this surge in violence in America, and what can America do to avoid this becoming the new normal? Now, to discuss this, we are pleased to have Libra X Sankara on our show. He is contributor and organizer with Troika Collective, and Dr. Rick Stagenborg, retired psychiatrist and political activist, joining us from Oregon. Now, let's start with some facts.
A recent FBI report shows homicides rose almost 5% in 2021. That's up 44% from just 2 years prior. Gun assaults were up by 7% in 2021. Reported drug crimes also increased for all drug categories except marijuana. And so far, there are no signs that the national murder rate is significantly falling.
And now Montana, South Dakota, Delaware, and Kentucky reported the highest increase in crime last year. So what are some of the possible factors in the rise in gun violence and homicide in the past couple of years?
The rising violent crimes here in the United States has to do largely with a disconnect between the United States government and the masses of working class people, and the fact that these two are not aligning. The government is pushing things that are benefiting corporations and businesses instead of focusing on helping the masses of working class people that during a pandemic got little, if any, support from the U.S. government. And we can look at the rising cost of living, the rising cost of food here in the United States, the fact that public schools are getting less funding in a time where people should be focused on staying alive.
Now, the pandemic is believed to have stressed and put pressure on institutions that were responsible for responding to violence, such as police, hospitals, and also community-based programs that seek to intervene when there is a pattern of high-risk crimes. However, in some European countries like the UK, crime rates actually dropped during the pandemic. So why did they go up in the U.S. in the first place?
What we saw throughout the pandemic was a lot of mental health issues, a lot of working class people trying to figure out how to get support in a time of need and not being able to focus on it, right? In the U.S., the government was focused on making sure businesses stayed open and forcing workers to go into work instead of what was happening in other countries where the government was able to send aid and money to folks so that they could stay home and make sure that the pandemic didn't spread further. And in the U.S., it was the exact opposite.
Another reason for the spike in violent crimes is the social unrest that followed the brutal killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020. There is a significant surge in homicides after that murder. Some people believe incidents like that and the cries for the defunding of the police have driven a wedge between police and communities that they serve, causing crimes to go up.
More guns. There is a significant surge in the purchase of firearms that began after the pandemic and continued afterwards. Data shows that guns purchased in 2020 also seem to be used in crimes more quickly than firearms bought in previous years. Now, a large part of the portion of these guns finds their ways into the hands of criminals. So what is it about this morbid fear of people buying more and more guns in America?
Here in the U.S., we can also see that there has been an increasing want of people to get access to guns. The reason for this is to have a sense of safety and feeling protected. But also, what we have to understand is that in the U.S., it is so easy to get access to a gun. There are not safety aspects in terms of education around safe use of a gun, where to keep it in the house, etc., as well as a lack of a mental health check, which I would say is a necessity for folks that would like to get access to a weapon.
So the conventional wisdom is that people buy more guns so that they feel safer. But if more guns meant more safety in general, the United States would have been the safest place on Earth because it has more guns than people. So that's really not the case.
The fixed position of people on the right and some people on the left
is that protecting gun rights, keeping guns from being taken away, is more important than public safety. And that's a defensible position, I suppose, if you believe that you're about to be attacked, and a lot of people do. People on both the right and left who support gun rights believe that the government is not their friend. The government is not working in their interest, and rightly so. Unfortunately, many of them regard guns as a potential protection against the government. And frankly, I think that's crazy. You're not going to be able to defend yourself against armies with long guns.
Research generally shows that where there are more guns, there is more gun violence. According to a Pew Research Center survey, roughly half of Americans favor stricter gun laws. Almost the same percentage believes that mental health assessments should be required by law for gun ownership.
Time and again, Americans have been heartbroken by the news of another mass shooting. This year also saw one of the deadliest mass shootings in American history. An 18-year-old opened fire at a Texas elementary school. Now, 19 children were killed in that attack. 19 families were left picking up the pieces. And yet, there's been no clear answer. Even the U.S. president is the one asking when these shootings are going to stop.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done?
These deaths are a predictable outcome of the U.S. lack of political will to make a change. A lot of evidence-based solutions say addressing the factors that increase the risk of gun violence, particularly in communities that are disproportionately impacted, can save lives. Yet, we see long a pattern of waiting and not doing anything in particular. That was especially enforced after the mass shooting in Texas.
Our kids are living in fear every single time they set foot in a classroom because they think they're going to be next. What are we doing? Why do you spend all this time running for the United States Senate? Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority? If your answer is that as this slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing.
And now, 4 months after that tragedy, it seems as if those politicians are still doing nothing, just waiting for the next mass shooting so they could deliver the same heart-wrenching sermons. There have been more and more calls for stricter gun controls, but at the same time, little has been done to curb gun violence.
Are you encouraged that lawmakers are actually trying to do something?
Okay. I am, but who knows, you know, they can always say all these things, but if it really passes, you know, that's a different, you know. But I'm glad, you know, if they'll come together into a consensus to do something, then that's, yeah, we'd love to see it.
The debate around gun violence has also become very partisan. Republicans blame Democrats and their so-called soft on crimes policies for the crime surge. Their narrative is very simple. Policing and sentencing are lax, so crimes go up. Is that really the case?
You know, we have conservatives and Democrats blaming each other for the overarching issues of crime in this country. You know, the conservatives will blame Democrats and say they are soft on crime, and the conservatives will say that we need to increase policing in our communities and that that's going to be the solution. Unfortunately, what we know is the reality in this country is that we live in a country with the highest mass incarceration rate. So this idea that policing and sentencing is more laxed under the Democratic or the Republican Party is a lie. When we look at the numbers, we see that it doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic or Republican presidency, that there are always increases in funding for policing.
You have Democrats blaming Republicans. They slammed the GOP for not passing stricter gun laws, for supporting and propagating theories that say that more guns means actually more safety. Interestingly, though, we see that the issue of gun violence becomes a campaign rallying cry for many from both camps whenever an election is approaching. And this year's upcoming midterm vote is no different.
The real issue is that Republicans and Democrats behind the scenes are pushing policies that push for more funding when there's no data that supports the idea that more police in a community creates more safety.
After the murder of George Floyd, some Democrats called for defunding of police in policy that seems to have backfired. Even President Biden is talking about funding the police rather than defunding. On the other hand, Republicans who derided and scored Democrats for supporting the idea of defunding the police are also talking about defunding the FBI because of Trump's home raid.
Defunding the police, the idea is that police are the first line of defense against social disorder, and they're overused and often make things worse. And I think the Black Lives Matter disturbances themselves are an example of that. I mean, that's a reaction to excessive police violence. All they're asking for is that the money that's spent on the police is invested in other things that are associated with crime, such as better community facilities for children to engage themselves in things besides hanging out on the street corner and taking or selling drugs. There are many different things that money could be spent on to lower crime besides police that would be much more effective.
By searching through the literature of crime in news outlets, we don't see much talking about the root causes of criminal behavior like deep poverty, mental illness, and lack of educational opportunities. But is that really why politicians are not talking about the root causes of crimes?
There's a good reason that we don't hear about the root causes of violence, which are, as you mentioned, poverty, lack of access to a lot of things that you need just to survive. These are symptoms largely of wealth inequality. In most countries, we have citizens have access to health care as a right of citizenship. That's not the case in the United States, which calls itself the richest country in the world. That's just one example of many ways in which the government has failed American citizens.
Now, research shows financial stability and economic opportunities are what help reduce crime. Short-term assistance appears to affect the rates of violence, and the timing of financial aid plays a role in community safety. People experiencing negative income shocks are less inclined to behave violently when they receive timely financial assistance.
In the U.S., under a capitalist system, we see that politics is used against the people, right? We view violence as like somebody hitting somebody else, but if we look at the work of Kwame Ture from the Black Liberation Movement, you know, he properly identifies that violence is a child going to sleep at night. Violence is not being able to afford housing. Violence is education not being a right.
Polls show that 4 in 10 U.S. adults say they live in a household with a gun, including 30% who say they personally own one. Around half of Americans see gun violence as a very big problem in the country today. About 8 in 10 black adults say gun violence is a very big problem, by far the largest share of any racial or ethnic group. So why is that cities populated mostly by black people see a disproportionate number of violent crimes?
There's a report by the Heritage Foundation that talks about the spike in crimes hurting a lot of people, especially our black communities that bear the heaviest burden. I think this is true for the simple fact that the founding of mass incarceration, the founding of prisons in this country happened right after slavery. In fact, the first police force in this country was actually slave catchers. Which explains the mass incarceration system and why statistically those most affected by the mass incarceration system are black communities, as well as indigenous communities that from the very beginning were genocided, forced into boarding schools, and there were attempts to erase the fact that they are even on this land. And so the increasing crime is always going to disproportionately affect our working class communities and communities that have the least access to resources.
Now, there's been numerous talk and debate about the rise in crime in America. So many questions have been posed as to why these crimes are rising, and there are already very satisfactory answers as well. Yet, every time there is a horrific murder or mass shooting, the issue of crime and policing resurfaces once again. Now, it seems as if the real issue here is not actually how to address crime. It is rather how to make the government believe the research-based solutions and actually enact them. And now let's see what Abbas Mutaqim has prepared for us this week.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's segment, we will take a brief look at some of the violence of the American Empire. And I said brief for a reason, because we could go on and on and on until the end of time discussing the violence and the atrocities committed by the American corporate regime. So in many ways, it's pretty much a contradiction to have the United Nations headquarters in the settler colony. But anyways, to get back to the point, if we look at the history of the founding of America, this land is not white people's land. It is indigenous people's land, not the Euro-Americans. But that did not stop white people from colonizing and stealing this land. And for this American project to develop into what it is today, it has and it continues to commit genocide against the indigenous people of this land, as well as it continues to commit genocide against Africans using enslaved African free labor to expand its empire. The founding of the first 13 states alone was enough to be some of the worst atrocities in human history. And as the Project of America expanded to 50 states, that expansion also continued the genocide of indigenous and black people. This violent American project, it created a haven for Euro-Americans to do what they want, when they want. And they created a segregated society in which whites are at the top, the capitalists are at the top, and black and indigenous people are at the bottom and are constantly exploited by the white mother colony of the so-called USA. And all this exploitation of black and indigenous communities has led to the American Empire to expand and exploit other nations throughout the world. America, it really truly can never get enough of the exploitation. And through this conquest, the American Empire has created a world order governed by their inhumane, imperialist, capitalist economics. And literally, the foundation of this American capitalist system is with the bodies of enslaved Africans, as black people were publicly traded and publicly worth more than money itself. And as the American capitalist dictatorships needed to expand to keep up these mass profits, they began colonizing other nations and setting up neo-colonies. By America doing this, it has led to the empire being in a perpetual state of war. If it ain't the constant war against black people in this country, the U.S. empire is doing it abroad as well. The so-called USA has been involved with over 100 conventional wars, and the American corporate regime uses a variety of different warfare tactics to use violence on other nations that don't bend to the will of American capitalist imperialism. American imperialism, they have also used unconventional methods of war to commit crimes against humanity. One of these is the USA's use of color revolutions, which are fake revolutions created by American clandestine and psychological operations to attempt to overthrow another nation's political leadership. America will fund the opposition and terrorist groups to attack the government in hope of regime change. It also relies on psychological warfare tactics through America's colonial control of the internet. And we have seen this used by CENTCOM, which is U.S. military's central command. They have an army of cyberbots that spread misinformation and that leads to violence. Even a former CIA official said that around 80% of Twitter users are fake. This is cyber imperialism. And another unconventional method of war used by America is sanctions, where America literally sanctions countries from vital resources like medicine, food, bans on exports, bans on access to a country's international assets, all to attempt to starve a country into submission. A proper interpretation of history, it shows us that America is responsible for the death of millions of black, brown, and indigenous people. The imperialist empire has no regard for humanity, and it's a historical fact that the U.S. empire is the biggest purveyor of violence in the world. And if the world is going to know any type of peace, America itself must be stopped by any means necessary. This is Power to the People.
And that was our program, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. Of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, "The one who dies and does not recognize the Imam of his time will actually die the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to provide you with the most information regarding the Imam of your time. Yes, this is the Last Savior. And today we're going to discuss the signs of the advent of Imam al-Zaman, Ajallaha Ta'ala Faraja. And on that note, today in our studio, we have with us a very special guest. We have Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when talking about the signs of Advent, they have been discussed a lot. There are certain signs that are known as very certain or definite signs of the Advent of Imam. And there are signs which are also discussed as uncertain or indefinite signs. We would want you to give us a brief introduction and then the types of these signs as well.
Sure. Alhamdulillah, there are many books written about what we call it Alam al-Zuhur, or the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. But the point is that there are many narrations in this regard, but in many of such books, we do not see any clarification about the authenticity of the narrations.
All right.
So all the narrations are put together, and then it may have some negative consequences. So some of these narrations are weak in terms of the chain, for example,
okay,
or in terms of the content. And we see that some false claimants or some ignorant people,
yeah,
by just reading one narration and ignoring others,
mm-hmm,
and by just referring to the content of the narration and without analyzing the chain of the narration and so on and so forth, they try to come to a conclusion that this is a sign mentioned in the narrations, and now we see the sign, so this is the alama, this is the sign for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
And they make such conclusions, and unfortunately some false claimants using this method try to mislead some people.
Yeah.
So it's very important for us to know the authentic narrations in this regard, to know about the real signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
Yeah.
May Allah hasten his reappearance. And as you mentioned, we have definite and indefinite ones, which of course I will come to that.
Yeah. All right. So we have people around who claim to be the Imam of the time, just going through these narrations that misleading people, actually misusing these narrations,
exactly,
because of the weak chain or a weak content of these narrations. They try to use these narrations and more mislead the ignorant people through this.
Yeah. So if I may have a definition for the term of alama al-zuhur,
yeah,
what do we mean by this alama, this sign? Some of our dear listeners might say that it's very clear, but the point is that alamat is the plural form of alama, and alama means sign, and sign is different from cause. This is a very important that we need to pay attention to.
All right, so here we come to a conclusion that sign, alam, is not just simple signs. It has some more brief definition. I'll ask that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and we're discussing about the signs of Advent. Yes, Dr. Karimi, you said that there's a definition of signs that we need to elaborate.
Let me give you and the dear listeners an example. For example, we say that the yellow face is a sign for one's illness.
Yes.
But is it a cause for the illness? I mean, yellow face is the cause and the illness is the cause?
No, it's just a sign
it
of
is
some
just
other
a sign.
Disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the cause is something else.
Yeah.
Or, for example, white hair might be a sign for an old age, but
yeah,
it is not the cause.
Yeah.
So this is the point. When we are talking about the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the important point is that the relation between the reappearance and these alamat is not a causal relation.
All right.
These signs are not the cause for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi,
okay,
alayhi salam. They are only signs.
The signs.
Yeah. Which means that they are just indicating the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and they are not the cause for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And the other conclusion is that for some of these alamat, which of course I will explain, they may not happen and their reappearance happens.
Yeah.
And with that, we come to this division among the alam al-zuhur or alamat al-zuhur.
The signs
of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they are divided into two categories. The mahtumat, I mean the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and the indefinite ones.
All right.
So there are many signs mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam for Akhir al-Zaman and for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. In this series of the show, I'm going to talk about only the definite ones.
All right. The ones
which are known as the definite ones, meaning if they do not happen, then, after them being happening, then we will have the reappearance
exactly. of Imam.
So why we have these two categories? The Shia scholars, they have analyzed all the narrations, and based on the number of the narrations for each sign and the authenticity of the chain, they have come to this conclusion, and of course the text of the chain, because in some of the texts, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam explicitly mentioned that there are definite signs and there are indefinite signs. So which means that the reason is based on the concept of Bada, which I will explain later in today's program. So the famous idea among the Shia scholars is that we have five signs which are definite.
All right.
We have a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in which he says, قَبْلَ قِيَامِ الْقَائِمِ خَمْسُ عَلَامَاتٍ مَحْتُومَاتٍ. Before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we have five signs which are mahtumat, meaning that they are definite.
They are definite, they are certain.
Yeah. One of them is Yamani, then Sufyani, then Sayha, which is a cry in the heaven. We'll talk about that. Qatlun nafs al-zakiyya. Nafs al-zakiyya will be killed. And al-khasfu bil-bayda. Burying in a land known as Bayda. We'll talk about all the details.
All right.
So according to the narrations and based on the analysis of the Shia scholars, these are among the five definite signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Of course, in this series, we'll discuss each
sign one by one. So we have five.
And to see whether they are definite or not. This is the famous viewpoint among the Shia scholars, right. But we will discuss that.
Inshallah, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Karimi and we're discussing about the signs of reappearance. Dr. Karimi, we reached a level where we said the signs of reappearance are generally categorized into definite and indefinite signs, the certain or uncertain signs. And now you, before the break, recited a narration from Imam Sadiq al-Islam, which says there are five definite signs, and I would want you to start explaining them one by one.
Okay, sure. Before that, let me also refer to some of the indefinite signs which are mentioned in the narrations.
All right.
And unfortunately, many false claimants just refer to these indefinite signs to mislead the people. So it's very important for our dear listeners to know that according to the famous viewpoint among the Shia scholars, we have only five definite signs.
Only five are definite, others are indefinite.
Five definite and the others are indefinite.
So actually people or the false claimants use these indefinite signs to misguide people.
Yeah.
We would want you to give a little intro about these indefinite signs as well.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we will come to the concept of Bada to say that what is the difference between definite and indefinite ones.
Yeah.
Because according to the famous viewpoint among Shia scholars, Bada may happen for the indefinite signs, but may not happen for definite ones. Inshallah, we'll discuss that later.
Okay.
So for example, in some narrations, it's been mentioned that solar eclipse in the mid of the holy month of Ramadan is a sign for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Now imagine that this year this happens. So is it true to conclude that so for sure Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is coming?